This shear is a redux of a shear that I gave already. But today I'm giving it Le'ilui Nishmat Moi V'Rabi Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzad V'Kadosh Livracha, on his Yurtzeit, Aleph Iyar. And I'm reflecting on some of the thoughts that I tried to express on Shabbat HaGadol about the most unlikely of aspects of the Seder to focus on. And that is the only aspect that is mentioned twice in the Simane HaSeder, Urchatz and Rachtza. Not once, but twice, we wash our hands during the Seder. What's the significance of it? Why does it matter not only on Pesach, but each and every day from the very earliest point in the morning when we wake up, that sometimes called Nagelvasser, or that Netilat Yadayim, through to each time that we eat bread, and any time our hands are unclean? Why is it so significant in Judaism, and why does it feature so prominently at the Leil HaSeder? So I hope that in reviewing some of that Shabbat HaGadol Drasha, I can bring some light to this concept that hopefully can inform people moving forward well beyond Pesach and into the year ahead. And as you'll soon see, there's a particular relevancy to mentioning this matter again now, between Parshiot Achrei Mot and Kedoshim. And for those who have reviewed Parshat Achrei Mot, and you'll understand immediately the context and the subtext of what I'm speaking about. And for those who have not yet done so, it's a good time to review Parshat Achrei Mot from beginning to end, as well as Parshat Kedoshim, a Parsha that calls us to Kedusha, as all of the Torah does, especially Sefer HaKedusha, Sefer Vayikra. I want to open with a story that appears in the Gemara Masechet Erevin, Adav Chaf Aleph Amud Bet. Many of us know the story about Rabbi Akiva's death, the ultimate story of his Mesirut Nefesh and indeed Kiddush Hashem. But fewer of us are familiar with the story that is, I would say, the penultimate story. It's the story of Rabbi Akiva already imprisoned and soon to be taken out to the gladiatorial arena in order to be tortured and murdered. This is a story that takes place in prison. Tanu Rabbanan Masav Rabbi Akiva Shehaya Chavush Beveita Asurin V'ha Rabbi Yehoshua Garsi Mesharta B'chol Yom V'Yom Hayu Machnisin Lo Mayim B'midah. There was the time when Rabbi Akiva was imprisoned, and Rabbi Yeshua Garsi, who was his attendant, would bring him each day water, a particular measure of water. Yom Echad, Matzo Shomer Beit HaAsurin, the guard, the jailer, at one point, accosts Rabbi Yehoshua and asks him, why do you have so much water today? Amar lo hayam meimecha, a merubin. Shemalachtor Beit HaAsurin atatzarich, are you doing this in order to be able to soften the ground and burrow your way out of the prison? So he takes the water away, and what happens? Shafach chetzian v'tan lo chetzian. He poured out half and gave him the other half. Kshebayitza Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua comes in, and speaks to Rabbi Akiva. Amar lo, said Rabbi Akiva to his student, Yehoshua, Ein ata yodea shezaken ani v'chayai tluin b'chayecha? Don't you know that I'm old and that my life is dependent upon yours? Sachlo kol oto hame'ora. And so the whole story was recounted by Rabbi Yeshua to his master. Amarlo, tainli mayim she'etol yadai. Rabbi Akiva says to Rabbi Yeshua, so give me the water, I want to wash my hands, netilat yadayim. Amarlo, lishtot in magin, litol yadecha magin. There's not enough water here in order to drink, to sustain yourself. You need it now to wash your hands? Amarlo, ma'ese, what should I do, said Rabbi Akiva. Shechayavim aleihem mita. Mutav amut mitat atzmi. Velo avor al dat chaverai. Very strange response. What should I do? If I don't wash my hands, I would be worthy of being put to death. I would be worthy of death. Presumably means mita bidei shamayim, death to hands of heaven. Better I should die on my own account, i.e. for using the water for the tilitim and not drinking it, but not to go against the thought of my friends. Velo avor al dat chaverai. Very strange. Amru lo tam klum, ad shehevi lo mayim v'natal yadav. They said that he refused to eat, adamantly refused, until he could wash his hands. Kshashamu chachami b'davar. When the sages heard about this outside of the prison, Amru, they said, Mabaziknuto kach bialduto achad kama v'kama. If this is how he is in his old age, you can just imagine what he was when he was young. In addition, umaba beta asurin kach, if this is how he is when he's imprisoned, shaloba beta asurin achad kama v'kama, you should just imagine what he was when he was outside of the prison. It's a strange story. And it's meant to be a heroic story, but it's very hard to understand what's being referenced here. How could Netilat Yadayim be so important in the life of Rabbi Akiva? He's willing to essentially endanger himself. Was that even halachically permissible to do? We'll come back to that in a couple of minutes. But some background about Netilat Yadayim. First of all, at least some kind of Netilat Yadayim already exists from the time of Shlomo HaMelech. It's in fact the very next Gemara. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, B'shash Atikin Shlomo Eruvin, U'Netilat Yadayim, Yatzta Bat Kol V'Amra, B'ni, Im Chacham Libcha, Yismach Libi, Gam Ani. Essentially, a heavenly voice proclaims, a Bat Kol proclaims, great praise for Shlomo HaMelech for having instituted, among other things, Netilat Yadayim. And this Netilat Yadayim actually is not the Netilat Yadayim for bread per se, but it's the Netilat Yadayim that we'll come to in a few minutes that has to do with purity and impurity when it comes to different kinds of foods that become tamei. Rashi writes, Netilat Yadayim lasot siag letaharot, in order to make some kind of a boundary around the realm of taharot. Further along, the Gemara here mentions that by making this Takana, these enactments, particularly of Netilat Yadayim, Shlomo HaMelech made Oznayim LaTorah. That means he made handles for the Torah. When he did this, the Jewish people can hold on to the mitzvot and distance themselves from Aveira, Rashi says. And just as it's easier to hold on to a vessel when it has a handle as opposed to when it does not. That's in terms of portability. I'm going to focus first on rachtza, what we generally call Netilat Yadayim at a meal, a Shabbos meal or Yontif meal, as much as a meal on any day of the week. We're obligated to wash our hands and make the bracha of Netilat Yadayim, recite that bracha, anytime we sit down to eat bread. Let's try to understand it a little more in depth. Firstly, the Gemara in Masechet Brachot tells us that the notion of washing one's hands has some kind of source in the Torah itself. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, V'amri lo matnita tana, this is the Gemara in Brachot, Daf Nun Gimel, Amud Bet, V'hit kadishtem, Elu mayim rishonim. You shall sanctify yourselves. Those are that's the washing we do before a meal. The Torah that this is based on, the Psukim it's based on, is also from Sefer Vayikra, from the end of Parshat Shmini, where it describes, Ki ani Hashem Elokechem v'kadishtem v'yitem kadoshim ki kadosh ani v'lo titam'u et nafshoteichem b'chol asher etzaromeis ala aretz. The end of the section about animals that are kosher versus non-kosher, and particularly the section of animals that are rodents or reptiles, and all different kinds of animals that are forbidden, and the notion that non-kosher animals are capable of creating a sense of impurity and vesting impurity in those who consume them. The Torah continues, Ki ani Hashem ha-ma'aleh etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim v'dot lachem lelukim v'yitem kadoshim ki kadosh ani. Because I am Hashem who has elevated you from the land of Egypt to be for you a God, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. That's in Parshat Shmini. And we're going to come to another one in Parsha Kedoshim. But just to see that the notion of Vihit Kadishtem, referring to the hand washing before a meal of Netilat Yadayim, is actually in the same section of the Torah, which is meant to contrast the Jewish people as having been sunken into depths of impurity in the land of Egypt, and having been raised therefrom and elevated therefrom by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore the aspiration to Kedusha having been raised out of a state of Tumah. Why is it that we only wash our hands and make a bracha for washing on bread and not for other foods? The Aruch HaShulchan writes, because that's the only time you have an achila of kvi'ut. A set meal is defined by the arrival of bread. And once one recites Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, that also means that of necessity they'll need to recite Birkat HaMazon. And therefore, says the Aruch HaShulchan, Kedusha Nikeret, sanctity is recognizable. It's going to be vested in the fact that one has to end the meal with the recitation of the brachot, which, by the by, are not like other brachot. Birkat HaMazon is itself a fulfillment of a bracha deoraita, v'achalta v'savata uveirachta t'Hashem Elokecha. And therefore, the recitation of Birkat HaMazon has itself elevated the meal that has just transpired, and therefore, v'nikeret ha-kedusha means that it's associated with washing specifically, in order to be able to eat bread. The Aruch HaShulchan also mentions that, of course, the bracha is Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvotav V'tzivanu Al Netilat Yadayim, which means who has sanctified us through his mitzvahs and commanded us. So he asks, rightly, where is that commandment? The first answer he gives is, it's from a pasuk that tells us about the authority of Chazal altogether, Mikra D'lo Tasur. And a second pasuk is actually from the end of Parshat Shmini, the aforementioned Gemara Masechet Brachot, Vihit Kadish Dem. So one is, this is enactment of the sages, it has that stature. On another level, it has what's called an asmachta, it's connected to the Torah in the word Vihit Kadish Dem. It doesn't render it a biblical mitzvah by any means, but it's attached to it and associated with the notion of Kedusha, this washing of hands. So that's the first idea. Rachza, what we call Netilat Yadayim before a meal, is a form of sanctification, connecting oneself to Kedusha and framing the meal itself. More directly, Netilat Yadayim, initially, and certainly the one that Shlomo HaMelech is referring to, seems to be about setting up a routine for the consumption of Truma. The Gemara in Masechet Chulin, Adaf Kuf Vav, lists two reasons why one must wash one's hands in order to eat bread, that are, at least one of them, is related to setting up some kind of a routine for the consumption of truma, of the tithes, that actually were only consumed truly by Kohanim, not by Yisraelim or Levim. Amarav Idi bar Avin, Amarav Yitzchak bar Oshian. Netilat Yadayim lechulin mipnei srach truma ve'od mishum mitzvah. Two reasons. One, Netilat Yadayim for every single person, by every single person, every time they eat chulin, which means unconsecrated food, a regular loaf of bread. Why? Mipnei srach truma, to set up a routine as regards the consumption of truma. If everyone will always at home have to wash their hands before they eat bread, Kohanim will do so as well, and therefore they'll be conditioned so that the main truma that they'll be eating, which is most likely grain products, they'll be ready, and it will be institutionalized for everyone. Second reason, because of a mitzvah. We'll come back to that one in a bit, because obviously it's pretty amorphous to call it a mitzvah. What mitzvah? Well, that's the Gemara's question coming up. But let's hold that for a minute. Let's stick with Srach Truma. The eating of Truma is actually a form of service of Hashem that, at least for Kohanim, can transpire at home. And, as we'll see momentarily, it even transcends the physical existence of the Mikdash itself. Let me explain. The Sifri on Bamidbar, which is the Medrash Halacha on Sefer Bamidbar, Parshat Korach, on Pisgah Kuf Tet Zayin, relays that Rabbi Tarfon was late one day to the Beit HaMidrash. Rabbi Tarfon, who lives after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, was late to come to the Beit HaMidrash in Yavne, presumably. Amar lo Rabban Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, said to him, Mara'it lishtahot, why were you late? Amar lo, Rabbi Tarfon said to him, Shayiti oved. I was busy, I'm a Kohen, I was busy doing an avoda, meaning a temple service. Amar lo, he said to him, Hello, kol dvarecha tema, v'chiyesh avoda achshav? What you're saying now makes no sense to me. Is there any kind of service now? Meaning, there's no Beit HaMikdash, so what do you mean doing a service? Amar lo answered, Rabbi Tarfon, Harehu omer avodat matana etein et kehunatchem. The Torah in Parshat Korach, referring to Truma, refers to it as a gift, which is a form of service, which will be given to the Kohanim. La'asot achilat kodesh migvulin ka'avodat mikdash b'mikdash. The consumption of Truma, even in the borders, meaning outside of Yerushalayim and outside the precincts of the Mikdash, but in one's home, is on a par with the service that is done in the Mikdash. In other words, he said to his Rabbi, it's true there's no Beit HaMikdash, but I feel when I eat Truma, that based on the way the Torah phrased the mitzvah, it really means that I am seated, as it were, at my table at home, but I'm engaged in more than just a physical act of consumption of something, of an object that was consecrated, the tithe given to Kohanim of Truma. I'm really doing an avoda. Indeed, this is the statement of the Sifrei itself. Avodat matana etenet kunatchem, lasot achilat kodshim bigvulim, kavodat mikdash b'mikdash. Just as one has a service in the mikdash, so there can be a service in the gvulim, which means in the border area, the frontier area, which just basically means anywhere outside of the precincts of the mikdash, in one's own home, eating from consecrated food. Ma avodat mikdash b'mikdash, mikadesh yadav v'chakach oved, Just as in the mikdash, when a person would come in to do the service, a kohen would come in to do the service, they already had to go to the mikveh before. But when they came in, they had to wash their hands and their feet at the kior, at the laver, the kior. So when they did that, if that's avodat mikdash b'mikdash, so the person would have to be mekadesh their hands, v'charkach oved, then they could do the service. So too, afachilat kachim mikvulim, mekadesh yidav v'charkach uchel. So too, outside, before one eats kachim, one has to wash one's hands and then eat. Rabbi Omer, further along the Sifri, la'asod achilat kachim mikvulim kavodat mikdash b'mikdash, mavodat mikdash b'mikdash, mekadesh yidav v'charkach oved, kachilat kachim mikvulim, mekadesh yidav v'charkach uchel. So it's basically a repeat, but Rabbi Yudah Nasi, of course, the codifier of the Mishnah, he comes later, so he's sort of sewing it up. But then it mentions, wait a minute, in the Torah it says you have to wash your hands and your feet. So Rabbi says, well, how come you don't have to wash your hands and your feet here? Answer, if you have an avodah that requires hands and feet, you'd have to wash your hands and your feet. In the Beit HaMikdash, no one was allowed to wear shoes. Nowadays, and that's what he writes, Malkum She'ein Sarach Ela Yadav, meaning you're going to eat the food, you don't need your feet to eat the truma. So therefore, you're just going to wash your hands, and that's how we learn Netilat Yadayim. He writes, Nimtzinu L'meidim Netilat Yadayim Min HaTorah. In other words, it is sourced somehow. The notion of the Tilat Yadayim, certainly for Truma, is itself sourced in the Torah. But where is it sourced? In the idea that Kohanim going in to do the service in the Mikdash must wash their hands. In their case, their feet also. Where does that leave us? Those of us who are not Kohanim. And Kohanim or not Kohanim. Chazal therefore instituted that every single Jew, every time they ever eat bread, regardless of whether there is or isn't truma being given to Kohanim, we have to be concerned that we're washing our hands to create a routine for it. So indeed, that's exactly the point. Hands are considered a certain level, a certain gradation of tuma. It's actually called level 2, shniyot. And even though, generally speaking, one is not concerned with this when we're talking about touching food, if one's hands are impure, we are concerned about that which has been consecrated, that which has a status of Kedusha. And indeed, Truma has a status of Kedusha. Again, the question is not answered. This is all true for Kohanim. Chazal had to make a decree that impacts me. I'm a Yisrael. I think there's an idea here about an aspiration that Chazal want us to have. It's the aspiration given to us at Matan Torah. We're coming in a few weeks to Zman Matan Toratenu. V'atem tiuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. And that means, as God told the Jewish people at Har Sinai, shall be for me a kingdom of Kohanim and a holy nation. Note the confluence of Kohanim and Kedusha. Are we not all aspiring to do that? Is it just a nice rhetorical flourish? Or did Chazal realize that as the sun was setting for the time period on the notion of the world of the Mikdash, that maybe, God forbid, the world of Truma, which is still tithed today, but is actually not given to Kohanim today and will not be until they arrive Mashiach Tzidkenu, perhaps there needed to be an aspiration on the part of every Jew to feel, I'm responsible. I wash my hands before I eat bread because I'm about to do an avoda. Yes, it's not an avoda actually in a Mikdash. True, I may not even be a Kohen. True, the objects of the food themselves are not vested with Kedusha per se. And yet, I feel I'm coming to my table as a form of avoda. And therefore, I am willing to wash my hands and make a bracha that I've raised up my hands and that hopefully will be raising up my food, if you will, at the time that I'm actually eating a meal. To put it in other language, the food does not acquire a status of hekdesh or kedusha, but I acquire a status of a sense of mission and purpose, that I'm part of that mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, and that should govern how I eat and when I eat, and also other aspects of life and living, as we'll see shortly. So that was the first idea in the Gemara in Chulin. It's mipnei srach truma, basically to set a routine as regards truma. That will be, everybody will do it, and that will enable Kohanim to get into the habit and the routine of doing so. The Gemara continues, and also mentions another reason, Mishum Mitzvah, on account of the Mitzvah. And the Gemara itself asks, my Mitzvah, what's the Mitzvah? Amar Abaye, Mitzvah Lishmoa Divrei Chachamim. It is a Mitzvah to hearken to the words of the Chachamim. Shetiknuha, says Rashi, they're the ones who enacted it. Rava, is he disagreeing with Abaye, or is he adding to Abaye? Rava Amar, Mitzvah Lishmoa Divrei Rabbi Lazar ben Arach. It's a mitzvah to listen to the words of Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, as the pasuk in Parshat Mitzora says, "V'chol asher yigabo hazav yadav l'shutaf b'mayim." The idea of anyone who touches this has to do with people who are ritually impure, not for now, but has to do with washing something in water. From here, did the sages have an attachment, some kind of association to Netilat Yadayim from the Torah? Again, V'id Kadishtem from the end of Parshat Shmini is also an Asmachta. And now we have the idea of the notion of Netilat Yadayim from Avodah, Avodat Matana, and as that Avodah required Netilat Yadayim, so too here, also connected to, according to Rebbe, to the Torah. Now a third idea, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, a pasuk in Parshat Mitzora about becoming Tahor, and this is here also something Min HaTorah. And according to Rava, Rashi holds that Rava maintains that this mitzvah is actually a mitzvah deoraita. He actually writes, deoraita hi mitzvah k'Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, and the disagreement between Abaye, who says it's a mitzvah to listen to what the Chachamim say, they enacted it, meaning they enacted it, and Rava adds, by the way, it's even deoraita, shows you the level in the hierarchy. So first we have Srach Truma, and two, it's a mitzvah, regardless of its rationale. Chazal made an enactment. But number three, it has certain roots in the Torah, whether it's deoraita or more likely, this asmachta. Now, let's go back to that story of Rabbi Akiva in prison. Now do you understand maybe a little bit better, perhaps, why he said that he needed to wash and seal Yadayim? He said, I can't go against my friends. I can't go against my colleagues. This is what they enacted, and I need to follow suit. I can't just let it go by the wayside. How could he endanger his life? So first of all, it's not clear that, halachically speaking, he was really required to give up his life over it. It's strange. Especially because, as the Baal Tosfot point out on this Gemara, if a person is in a state of danger, one of the things that they don't have to keep, and a makam sakana, is netilat yadayim. So what was he doing? So the Baal Tosfot would say he was machmir on himself. Was he allowed to be machmir? There are different answers that are propounded. I think the one that's most resonant for me is based on the Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin Daf Ayin Dalad. And that describes, that Gemara is talking about when a person should give their life rather than violate a Jewish principle. There are only three times that a person should give their life rather than violate a particular mitzvah. Everything else, we basically say one should violate that principle, that mitzvah, in order to save their life, live to fight another day. But the three things are murder, adultery, idolatry. Those three things, a person, if they are forced to either commit those acts or die instead, they should give their life. However, the Gemara says, there is an exception. And the exception is an Ashat Shmad. Ashat Shmad means a period of time that has persecution running rampant against the Jewish people. It's a time of genocide, God forbid. It's in the air. And Rabbi Rav Dimi quotes in the name of Rabbi Yochanan in that Gemara, then Shat Shmad, afilu mitzvah kala yagra al yavor. A person should give their life for an easy, simple mitzvah. So what's a mitzvah kala? What's an example of mitzvah kala, the Gemara asks. So Rava Bar Yitzchak clarifies in the name of Rav, afilu shinuye arkata de misa'ana. That means if the Jewish people have a particular kind of a shoelace that they wear, and the non-Jewish world comes forward and says, we want you to change it. If it's a shat shmad, meaning the system is under attack, you can go to, you can allow your life to be taken in order to set down the law, if you will, that the system is under attack and you're resisting at every turn, even on something as simple and as basic as the color of a shoelace. Now, how is the system under threat here, and what did it have to do with Netilat Yadayim? In his work, Pesach Dorot, Professor Yosef Tabori gave me the answer to this conundrum. The answer is that there are actually three sources in the New Testament, which I've actually went to look up. You can Google it and look them up, based on what he put in his book. There are three sources, direct sources, where early Christians are launching polemics and critiques of the Jewish people, of what they call Pharisees, the Prushim, that's us, about Netilat Yadayim. They say, the Jews and the Pharisees, they don't eat bread until they wash their hands because they follow the words of their elders. But what's going on? The early Christians, who I'll remind you, of course, were Jewish, they're saying basically back to the Prushim, to the Rabbanim, to the Jews who are faithful to our Mesorah, they're saying to them, you think Hashem cares about you having clean hands? He doesn't care about that. He wants your soul to be clean. So why are you wasting your time washing your hands? The quote from one of them is actually in the opposite direction. The Prushim are directly berating Oto Ha'ish and his disciples for not washing the Tilat Yadayim before they sit down to bread. And indeed, another testimony elsewhere, the Prushim saw Oto Ha'ish eating without Netilat Yadayim. Okay, now, you understand Rabbi Akiva in another light. Now, you understand a little bit better why he turns around and he says, I can't go against my friends. If I eat without Netilat Yadayim, that's going against not only my friends, but he means what the Mesorah stands for. It will be to adopt the early Christian ways. And one of the main fault lines between the two of them is who washes for bread and who doesn't wash for bread. If we understand this, then we understand a very strange story that appears in several Midrashim. It's alluded to in the Gemara in Yuma on Daf Pei Gimel. It's in Gemara Chulin, Daf Kuf Vav. And it's also in Bamidbar Rabbah. So in the version of Bamidbar Rabbah, here's how it goes. It was a story at a time of a decree. It doesn't say which decree. It says there's a storekeeper, or actually an innkeeper, who's Jewish, who had two pots. One pot he has basar tahor, kosher meat, and the other pot he cooks pig. Why? So that the non-Jewish world will not realize that he's actually Jewish. Shelo yargishu bo shehu Yehudi. Those people won't know. This is his minhag. Whoever comes into the store and doesn't wash their hands for bread, he realizes this must be an idolater, and he puts pig before them. Whoever does wash their hands and makes the bracha, he can see this is a Jew, and he gives them kosher meat. One time a Jew comes in to eat, and he doesn't wash his hands. So the store owner thinks this is a non-Jew. What does he put in front of him? Pig. The man ate, he didn't make a bracha. The end of the meal, Bala soti mocheshban lapat v'labasar, the man came forward to the innkeeper to pay him for the bread and the meat. Amarlo, he said to him, Yesh li alecha kach v'kach min abasa shechalta, shechaticha ola asara mana. He tells him you have to pay for the meat, a piece is worth 10. So the customer says, Amarlo, he said to him, Etmol achalti ota bechet. Yesterday the market was 8. Vayomata ratzili told me many asara, you want 10 now? The storekeeper said, Amarlo, no, he said to him, Zusha achalta shel chaziri. What I gave you was pig. Says the Medrash, Kevin Sha'amarlo, Kach, when he heard these words, Amdu Sa'arotav, his hair stood up on the back of his head. Nivhal, he was terrified. Vnechpaz, he was beside himself with upset. Amarlo Batsini said to him surreptitiously, Yehudi ani, Venatatli Basar Chazir? I'm a Jew, you gave me pig? Answered the innkeeper, Tipach Ruchacha, Shekshara'iti, Sha'achalta, B'lo Natilat Yadayim, V'lo Baracha, Hayiti Sivur Shata, Oved Kochavim. I saw you didn't wash your hands. You don't recite Natilat Yadayim. I thought you were an idolater. Mikan Shanu Chachamim, Mayim Rishonim Hechilo, Basar Chazir. What's the critique of the early Christians? There's no point to this Takana. It makes no sense. Why bother? There's no Beit HaMikdash, who cares about Truma? There'll never be a Truma again. There'll never be a Beit HaMikdash again. That's number one. Number two, there's not going to be rituals. Ethics are all that matter. Do charitable works. And all the rest is bunk. And Judaism stood up and said, wrong. Wrong. We have another way. We have a Mesorah. We have roots of this in the days of Shlomo HaMelech as regards Teharot generally, meaning purity and impurity as regards foods. We have the notion about Truma. We're concerned about this, these features of our life and our Jewish living. We're not going to give them up so easily. We understand the arguments that you're making and we reject them wholesale. Whether it's a form of sanctification to wash one's hands and or the setting up of a routine for eating Truma, an aspiration for the future, the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, whether it's the idea that we are just simply listening to a mitzvah that was given to us by our forebears, that was a takana of Chazal, that in and of itself is enough. This would also explain, if we understand this, how Rav Amnon Bazak of Yeshivat Har Etzion understands the Ben Harasha at the Seder. You know, in our version of the Seder, the Ben Harasha doesn't exactly add up. Rasha Mahu Omer. Ma avodah zot lachem, lachem velo lo, him and not you. Ulefisha hotziat atzmo min haklal kafar beikar, he took himself out of the mix, he took himself out of being part of the Jewish people, so that's some kind of a heresy against a prime directive about Judaism. Kafar beikar is the mainstay of Judaism, he pushed away. So what should he do? Vafatah hakeyat shinav, blunt his teeth, meaning blunt the force of his words by saying to him, Bavur zeh asah Hashem libet zeh timin yitzrayim, livelo lo ilo hayasham lo yanigal. Says Rav Amnon Bazak, you know that this version that everyone has in their Haggadah, did you ever look up the version of this exact Ben Harasha in the Talmud Yerushalmi? Just listen to the words. Ben Harasha ma'u omer, ma'avoda zot lachem, ma'atorach hazeh shetem matrichim aleinu b'chol shana v'shana. What is this bother? Avoda means a bother, trouble that you put upon us year in, year out, this burden. Mikaven shotzi, and that's moment of klal, afata and morlo, say to him, Bavur za asa shemli. Now listen carefully, says the Yerushalmi, li asa l'oto ha'ish lo asa. He took me out and did it for me, but not for that man. Ilu haya oto ha'ish b'mitzrayim, lo haya ra'ui lihige'el misham le'olam. If oto ha'ish had been in Mitzrayim, he would not have been worthy of having been redeemed. Writes Rav Amnon Bazak here in the English translation, the Yerushalmi presents a lengthier question posed by the wicked son, adding to the earlier texts the clause, what is this trouble that you are forcing upon each and every year? This question, says Rav Bazak, appears to address the exertion entailed in fulfilling the mitzvot each year and likely reflects the Christian approach, which tended to undermine the importance of mitzvah acts. If so, then we could perhaps suggest a novel explanation for the response given to the wicked son. He did for me and not for that person, Oto Ha'ish. Oto Ha'ish. If that person had been in Egypt, he would never have been worthy to be redeemed from there. As we know, the term Oto Ha'ish, says Rav Bazak, often refers to the founder of Christianity. If this is the intent in this context, then the response of, if that person had been in Egypt, Oto Ha'ish had been in Egypt, he would never have been redeemed, takes on a special significance. Oto Ha'ish, that person represents for his followers the redemption of the world. Yet had he been in Egypt, he himself would never have earned redemption. Earlier, concludes Rav Bazak, we noted that the Haggadah's response to the wicked son is surprisingly harsh and unsympathetic. According to what we have seen now, we might suggest an explanation. The Haggadah speaks not of a son who simply ridicules Torah observance, but rather of a son who has rejected the Torah and joined a different faith. As such, the parent must avoid at all costs his negative influence upon the other family members as part of the comprehensive struggle against the influence of Christianity upon Jews at that time. End quote. Now, Netilat Yadayim and the Leil HaSeder, mitzvah lishmoa divrei chachamim. It's a mitzvah to listen to the words of the sages. A Rabbi Akiva sitting with the five chachamim b'nei brak, but also not just to hear their words about the Leil HaSeder, not just their beautiful drushes and sermons, but also their takanot. And one of those takanot, which again has roots in the Torah and roots with Shlomo HaMelech, but the roots of it and its enactment finally are with the authority of Chazal. Contrast that with the Ben HaChacham's question. Chacham mahu amir, ma'edot v'chukim v'mishpatam shotziv Hashem elokeinu etchem. What's the question? It's detailed. Eidot, that's Shabbat, that's Tefillin, it's mitzvah to testify to our most sacred commitments, values, ideas, ceremonies, and the like. What are mishpatim? The rational mitzvahs. We can explain it to any person in the world and they would get it immediately. Ah, it makes a lot of sense to me. What are the chukim? Sandwiched in between Eidot and Mishpatim? That's a challenge. That's a real challenge. It's a challenge that we're facing now, that we've been facing for millennia. And the chok of the world of Tumah and Tahara is at the epicenter of this challenge of impurity and purity. I want to share an idea with you from a book that I read over the last period of time that I've recommended to many friends and family with a warning that it is not for children or younger readers based on its content and some of the examples thereof. It's a book by a professor from UVA from Charlottesville, Virginia, Jonathan Haidt. The book is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. I want to share with you one aspect of this book, not about politics, but a little bit about religion, and particularly about an insight that he had about himself that really helped me better understand how crucial the element of Tumah and Tahar and the world of Kedusha and Kodesh and Chol is to us as Jews, as Torah-abiding Jews, as Jews who are connected to an Orthodox community and to a Mesorah. But for so many of us who have ourselves also immersed in a general culture in some way, I'm growing ever concerned that it is falling on hard times. So let me explain. Jonathan Haidt explains that he is weird. Weird, not in the sense of being strange, but in the sense of an acronym he came up with, the word weird. And that is Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And that, in fact, he didn't come up with this idea. It was others who coined this phrase called the weirdest people in the world. And it was a study from 2010. It claimed that people who live in weird societies have particular ideas about morality. And Jonathan Haidt says, I was part of that as well. Why shouldn't I be? Describes himself as a person who grew up in the New York area, and he's an atheist, that he's liberal, and he's an academic, etc. But essentially, he says, I too accept the idea, as many of my fellow weird people accept, that all of morality can really be boiled down to, in Western culture, one thing, the harm principle. John Stuart Mill put this forth in 1859. He said, the only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. End quote. In other words, the only question that should be asked about whether something is moral or immoral is this hurting anyone else? And as long as the answer is it's not hurting anyone else, morality has no claim on it, and no one in society should have any value judgments whatsoever about its morality or lack thereof. So, Jonathan Haidt explains that he got a grant to become a Fulbright scholar. And he decided that he wanted to study the ideas of a professor at University of Chicago named Richard Schwader. Richard Schwader was the leading thinker in cultural psychology, which Haidt explains a new discipline that combined the anthropologist's love of context and variability with the psychologist's interest in mental processes. So, there's a theory of morality that Schwader came up with based on research he did in India, in Orissa, the province of Orissa in India. And so here's how it goes. The ethic of autonomy, which is the John Stuart Mill idea, is based on the idea that people are first and foremost autonomous individuals with wants, needs, and preferences. And people should be free to satisfy those as long as they don't hurt anybody else, writes Jonathan Haidt. But as soon as you step outside of Western secular society, you hear people talking in two additional moral languages. The ethic of community is based on the idea that people are, first and foremost, members of larger entities, such as families, teams, armies, companies, tribes, and nations. These larger entities are more than the sum of the people who compose them. They are real, they matter, and they must be protected. People, he writes, have an obligation to play their assigned roles in these entities. Many societies, therefore, develop moral concepts such as duty, hierarchy, respect, reputation, and patriotism. In such societies, the Western insistence that people should design their own lives and pursue their own goals seems selfish and dangerous, a sure way to weaken the social fabric and destroy the institutions and collective entities upon which everyone depends. So that's community. Next, the ethic of divinity, explains Jonathan Haidt, is based on the idea that people are, first and foremost, temporary vessels within which a divine soul has been implanted. People are not just animals with an extra serving of consciousness. They are children of God and should behave accordingly. And so Jonathan Haidt says he was captivated by these ideas of Professor Richard Schwader at University of Chicago. And when he applied for and got his Fulbright Fellowship, he got it in order to spend 3 months in India to get a closer look at the ethic of divinity. Where did he go? to Bhubaneswar, the capital city of Orissa. And he explains that, in fact, he got there, he sat down at the table, he saw a totally different way of life. He saw the way people interacted in a totally different way. It wasn't his way, and at the beginning he had trouble understanding how and why it worked that way. But the more he thought about the fusion of the ideas of Richard Schwader, that ethics does not just come down to autonomy questions, but also, in much of the world, questions about its impact on community and on divinity, he saw things in a different way. I read again from Jonathan Haidt from the book The Righteous Mind. It took him a few weeks, he says, for the dissonance to disappear. And he says as follows, "I began to see a moral world in which families, not individuals, are the basic unit of society, and the members of each extended family, including its servants, are intensely interdependent. In this world, equality and personal autonomy were not sacred values. Honoring elders, gods, and guests, protecting subordinates, and fulfilling one's role-based duties were more important." And he goes on to say, further along, moving away from the ethic of community and talking then about the ethic of divinity, he says, "I saw that too." And he says, "I looked around." He said, "There I was in Bhubaneswar interviewing Hindu priests, monks, and lay people about their concepts of purity and pollution and trying to understand why Hindus place so much emphasis on bathing, food choices, and concerns about what or whom a person has touched." He asks, "Why do Hindu gods, small g, care about the state of their devotees' bodies?" And he puts in brackets, "And it's not just Hindu gods. The Quran and the Hebrew Bible reveal similar concerns, and many Christians believe that cleanliness is next to godliness." So there's an idea here about what he ends up referring to as a notion that morality outside of Western culture has more axes of understanding. In Western culture, he identifies three, in weird societies, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic, three axes that are the heaviest focus. Care versus harm. Asking that question, is it harming someone? Is it caring for others? Number two, is this fair? The fairness versus cheating. Number three, liberty versus oppression. Being free as a value. The other three, which exist in America, and they do exist in Western cultures, but much more so in more traditional side of the culture generally, loyalty versus betrayal, a loyalty to a cause, loyalty to a people, loyalty to a family, a nation, authority versus subversion, having a sense that authority is in and of itself something positive, and finally, sanctity versus degradation. There is an element of kedusha, what we would call kedusha. Further along in the book, Haidt explains what he means by this sanctity foundation of morality. The sanctity foundation makes it easy for us to regard some things as quote-unquote untouchable, both in a bad way because something is so dirty or polluted we want to stay away, and in a good way because something is so hallowed, so sacred, that we want to protect it from desecration. If we had no sense of disgust, he says, I believe we would also have no sense of the sacred. And if you think, as I do, that one of the great unsolved mysteries is how people ever came together to form large cooperative societies, then you might take a special interest in the psychology of sacredness. Why, he asks, why do people so readily treat objects? His examples are flags or crosses. Places, his examples, Mecca, a battlefield related to the birth of your nation. People, saints and heroes. And principles, his examples, liberty, fraternity, equality, as though they were of infinite value. Whatever its origins, the psychology of sacredness helps bind individuals into moral communities. When someone in a moral community desecrates one of the sacred pillars supporting the community, the reaction is sure to be swift, emotional, collective, and punitive. When we think about Yetziat Mitzrayim, we all readily understand that Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, our whole narrative as Jewish people of Zeichut Yetziat Mitzrayim, is of course about those first three axes. Care versus harm. What harm was done to us that we ought not inflict on others. The notion of fairness and justice versus the cheating and the injustice of what transpired to us. And of course, freedom, liberty. It's Yetziat Mitzrayim bad geula, obvious. the Rabbi Akiva story in prison, and in fact, I'm arguing Yetziat Mitzrayim and the Leil HaSeder is also about the latter three, about loyalty to a tradition, about a sense that authority matters, and that the notion of sanctity and degradation, that axis of morality, is part and parcel of what it means to be Jewish. Not three axes of morality, but certainly all six. And what is the source of all of these? It's, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We understand this, we can understand what it means that actually the whole concept of morality is at stake every time we come down to the Seder. Not just in terms of care and fairness and liberty, but also to strengthen our bonds of loyalty to family, to nation, to concepts of Jewish history, the sense of authority, not just of the Torah HaKadosha and the Torah Shebichtav, but also Torah Shebaal Peh and to a Masorah, and of course, Rachza and Urchatz, both of them, all about sanctity and degradation. And now we understand Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is saying, I may be right now in a state of imprisonment, but to go against my friends and betray them, my colleagues who have enacted this, the washing of hands before one eats, to defy the authority of Chazal, even if I'm one of the members of Chazal, I am a shareholder, I'm a stakeholder, I'm actually Rabbi Akiva. But that would not be enough. And then finally, the idea that even in a place of degradation, such as a prison, it could still be Kedusha and an aspiration to Kedusha. The Pesik of Rav Kahana says, with regard to Parah Aduma, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was sitting with his Talmidim, and he at one time said to them, regarding Parah Aduma and the whole sanctity, the whole notion, excuse me, of Tahara on account of the Parah Aduma, he said to them, Chayechem, Lohamet Metame, Vlohamai Metarim, Elegzerot Shlach Kodesh Baruch Hu. The truth is, nothing inherent in the dead body, there's nothing inherent in the water that's causing the purification of the Parah Aduma. Rather, what is everything? Everything is the decree of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's what creates Tuma and Tahara. Our acknowledgement of Tuma and Tahara is our acknowledgement of the divinity, so to speak. I don't really like that word. The element of Kedusha, or lack thereof, in a given object. The notion that an object can become closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu once it is Tahor, and that Tuma means a distancing from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Rambam codified this at the end of Hilchot Mikvaot. Davar barur v'galui, shatumot v'atarot gzerot akatuvhein. It is clear and revealed that everything we do with impurity and purity is a scriptural decree. This is not something that the mind of a person can figure out or decide. Rather, it's a chok. And he writes that tevila itself, even immersing in a mikvah, everything, it's all a chok. The tuma is not actually the objects, but rather the gzeret akatuv. V'adavar talui b'kavanat halev. Everything is associated in the intention of the heart. And therefore, the Chachamim goes on to describe all about the issues of Tuma and Tahara as a central pillar of what it means to be Jewish. And in a world, a Western culture that has so often reduced morality away from the notions of loyalty and authority and sanctity and only wants to see things through the prism of John Stuart Mill's notions of care versus harm, we're the ones who have to come to our Seder and affirm not just Rachza, but also Urchatz. You see, Urchatz is something that is not really just related to Pesach. It's a halacha generally about wet produce. And as I say often, the world of Tuma and Tahara is a series of metaphysical laws of the universe. I got this from Rav Soloveitchik from one of his essays. I don't remember which one now. But the idea is that there are physical laws of the universe. There are metaphysical laws of the universe. Tuma and Tahara are metaphysical in nature. So this isn't really related to Pesach per se. It's a halacha that if produce gets wet, specifically vegetables, think of pickles or olives that are immersed in liquid, that really anything that is dipped in liquid requires until it's done before one eats it. Amar Rabbi Lazar, Amar Reoshia, the Gemara in Pesachim, kol shtipul b'masket tzarich netilat yadayim, you have to wash your hands. My recollection from my Seder, of course, is that every time we get to Urchatz, my father, you should live and be well, says, no bracha. And we still do it today at my Seder. Get to Urchatz, no bracha. Everyone announcing, no bracha. The Rashbam explains that we're talking about some kind of vegetable that is in vinegar and some kind of brine, whatever it might be. Why? Because the hands are shniot lutuma. They are a secondary layer of ritual impurity. It's a gzera itself, a decree of the sages. And anything that has the capacity to touch truma, if there was truma in one's home, and to make it tame, the other, while it can't be matame regular food, it can be matame liquid. And liquid is considered more, call it, unstable from a tumah tahara perspective. And that liquid would then be matame the food that you're eating. Now, this may seem complicated, but it's not all that complicated. Why? Because we don't do it most of the year. There's only one night of the year that we pull it out. So why is that? The Bali Tosfot point out that this washing of hands for urchatz, when we dip the karpas, the vegetable, into the salt water, is unlike the washing for bread. The washing for bread, the Bali Tosfot write, is mishum kedusha unikiyut, both for sanctity and for cleanliness. This one is to prevent tuma. Why should we care? I mean, so we'll be matame ourselves. It seems the rest of the year we don't care. So the Bali Tosfot say that generally there's a gzera against being matame oneself through the consumption of tame foods, and ideally it would be good if people held to it. But in the end, the Bali Tosfot, according to the understanding of the Prima Gadim, the Chazon Ish, are really basically saying that this is an issue of zihirut, of being vigilant. And essentially, the Bali Tosfot write, we're just not nizhar about this today. We're simply not vigilant about it. The kol shekein anan, the Bali Tosfot, she'ein anu nizhar, mi lektamot atzmeinu, mi lechol, ochlin temeyin. Ve'enu tzrichin lo tatinatila. We don't have to wash anymore for wet vegetables because we're no longer vigilant from this kind of tumah. We've lost the sensitivity. It's like a lost art. We just don't do it anymore. And therefore no bracha. Contrast this to the Rambam and others who actually maintain that in fact one should make a bracha. The Rambam in Hilchot Chametz Matzah in the 8th chapter says, V'acharkach mivarech al natil yadayim v'notil yadav. Wash your hands. And make the bracha and wash your hands, and then eat. Bali Tosfot say no bracha. Rabbi Meir of Rutenberg is quoted in Hagot Maimonim. What does he say? Zeu davke b'dor rishonim she'nisarim b'tahara. They were much more careful about issues of purity. Aval anu ein levarachon tilazu. We don't have to do it. V'chein ha'iragel la'asotim b'lo bracha. V'chein pirshu ha'tosfot. Rabbi Meir of Rutenberg, who was alive at the end of the 13th century, he didn't do it. He's among the last of the Bali Tosfot. So we don't make a bracha anymore. It's not like the washing for bread, which is an issue for Srach Truma, as we saw, or it's a mitzvah, as discussed there in the Gemara and Chulin. This one is just, we're not careful about it, so we don't really have to do it anymore. What do Rashi and the Rambam say, such as they do require an actual bracha on urchatz? The answer is, they think it's a gzeira. According to the Rosh and the Tamid de Rabbeinu Yonah, they think this gzeira, the enactment about washing for wet vegetables, is in force just like it was during the time period way back when. Why? Because it's just like Srach Truma. We want to routinize issues of Tuma and Tahara for others. So of course you should make a bracha. For the Rambam, there seems to be a continuity between the Tilat Yadayim on bread, which requires a bracha, and for anything that is Tibul Mashke, that you are dipping a vegetable into something that is wet. I said also make a bracha, right? It's the Rambam, Hilchot Bracha, Kol Ochel HaPat, Shemavarchin Alev Hamotzi, Tzarech Tilat Yadayim Techlev Asof. You should wash your hands. I'm skipping some of the words, but basically it's Tilat Yadayim. Vav Bishi Pat Chulin, even though it's not sacralized bread, it's not with kedusha of truma. Even if your hands aren't actually physically dirty, you don't know that they're ritually impure per se. You should wash your hands before you eat. Don't eat before you wash your hands. Anything that's dipped in liquid has to have the washing of hands in the tilat yadayim beforehand. He draws a line, in other words, between these two contexts. He thinks they're the same. Again, for the Bali Tosfot, two separate roots. One is Srach Truma and the mitzvah to hearken to the words of the Chachamim. It's about Nikiyut, which is cleanliness. It's about Kedusha, sanctity. But for the Rambam, and Bali Tosfot hold that for the world of Urchatz, meaning for anything that's dipped, a wet vegetable, etc., so that we don't have anymore, just not sensitive to it. The Rambam says, no, everything is exactly the same and should be kept as it was way back when. What does the Shulchan Aruch write? No tal yadav l'tzarech tibul rishon v'lo yavarach anatila. No bracha. Wash your hands for urchatz, no bracha. Take the karpas and dip it, etc. The Taz asks the question. Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol yamim shebashana. It's a play on words, yeah? Manishtana. You didn't care the rest of the year. So tonight you suddenly come to the Seder. Oh, now everybody cares about it. So the Taz goes on to write, truly, it should be done all year round. Yeah, this night's supposed to teach you that all year round you should really keep it. Why are you bothering, right? We should be more consistent. Indeed, there are many poskim who follow this. The Mishnah Berurah himself writes that we should be more stringent about it. Personal disclosure, right now I'm not makpid on it at all, but that's what the Mishnah Berurah says. You really should follow the Taz. Others disagree, but that's his idea. And the Taz writes, you know, if you want to be more stringent about this, you know the best time to do it is during the Aseret Yemei Teshuva, when you're trying to show a Kadosh Baruch Hu you're walking the extra mile. Now, Pesach, why are you bringing it up now, per se? By the by, the Vilna Gaon thinks you should make a bracha. The Magen Avraham is really, in the name of Lechem Chamudot, he writes, most people are not makpid on this, and therefore there should not be a bracha on the Urchatz at the Seder. As most people are just not makpid on it during the rest of the year. Okay, so for those who are not strict the rest of the year, doesn't the question return? Manishtana halayla hazeh, so why are you doing a Leil HaSeder? A few approaches. First of all, Rav Reuven Margoliad in his Haggadah writes that this netila is derech cheirut usrara. This shows freedom. This shows a sense of mastery of one's own destiny. Why? You can clean your hands, even before a little bit of food. A person who is living in squalor, or who's living as a prisoner, they don't have that kind of luxury. The night of the Seder, this is our affirmation. The affirmation that we have is, tonight we're free. And that differentiates this night from other nights. We're affirming our ability to be clean. The Netziv writes that the Leil HaSeder is meant to be a time machine. We're harking back to a bygone era and an as yet unwritten era, but one which we project on the Leil HaSeder, a time of the Beit HaMikdash. And perhaps that's exactly the idea of why we should wash our hands and be careful about Tibula B'Mashke, at least giving a nod to it at the Seder. We're remembering what was a living memorial, and we're also projecting about, God willing, what will be by next year. And perhaps this is just like what the Levush says about the issue of Netilat Yadayim during the whole year for bread. The Levush says, someday soon, all of these halachot will be relevant again. The Aruch HaShulchan quotes Levush Va'afagav de'ein lanu truma bizman hazeh, mikol makom mehera yibana beit hamikdash, v'yeh lanu truma v'nidali zarba. We'll be ready. When truma comes back into the world, at least for Kohanim, who'll be eating the truma, they'll know. And they can't touch it unless they've washed their hands to make sure not to defile the truma and to cause it to become tameh. The third idea, the Chok Yaakov says, it's very simple why you do this at the Seder. Simply, so that the children will ask. Kadeshi shalu hatinokot ala shinoi. The Chok Yaakov is quoted in the Shar HaTzion right here in Siman Tov Ayin Gimel Neshulchan Aruch. The children should ask a question. Manishtana halayla hazeh. How different is this night where we care actually about Tuma and Tahara in the world? The children should ask, what is Tuma in this world? What is Tahara in this world? The night of the Seder is not just the Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim of the physical march of Klal Yisrael out of the depths of depravity of Egypt, physical, but also spiritual. It's a worldview that eschews the world of Tumah and aspires to Tahara, and from there a climb to Kedusha. If Egypt was obsessed with a death cult, Judaism is obsessed with life. Their priests, their Kohanim, Lahavdol, are priests whose lives are obsessed with death rites. For us, our Kohanim turn around and run away from death. Leaving Egypt is not just an exodus physical, of course. It's also being raised out of the 49 levels of Tumah. Ki ani Hashem hama'ale etchem eretz Mitzrayim liot lachem elokim v'yitem kedoshim ki ani Hashem. Ki kadosh ani, excuse me. For I am Hashem, who elevates you out of the land of Egypt, is the end of Parshat Shmini again, to be for you a God so that you can be sanctified, for I am sanctified. Meaning, emulating God is aspiring to and achieving Kedusha. What is Bracha of Netilat Yadayim? Literally, it means to wash one's hands. The Ritva in Chulin says, Netilat Yadayim is from the language of Se'u Yadechem Kodesh, meaning, Netilah means to take something in hand. When I make the bracha Netilat Yadayim, I am signaling that I have taken my hands in hand. Like the bracha Al Netilat Lulav means to pick up the lulav. Al Netilat Yadayim means I am raising up my hands, that which will engage the world. Some of us know of family members who, after they wash their hands in Netilat Yadayim, they actually physically lift up both hands in the air before they make the bracha. Some of them even recite the pasuk from Tehillim, Si'u yadeichem kodesh uvarachu et Hashem. Raise up your hands in sanctity and bless God. And that's the idea about why it is that we wet our hands first and then we make the bracha. I'm not making the bracha as the Rambam. The Rambam argues you make the bracha like any other bracha. Make a bracha and then perform the act. Not here. Here, we make the bracha when our hands are wet, in order to signify that right now I've wet my hands means I have now been mitahir my hands, or now I have elevated my hands to nikiyut and kedusha. And doing this, now I can make the bracha al netilat yadayim. Lashon netilat yadayim, lashon su yadeichem kodesh. That's why when we leave a Beit Olam, we leave a cemetery, the encounter with death, we get away from it. That's the minhag Yisrael. We wash our hands. Truth to tell, absent the para aduma, we have not gotten away from the tumat meit that falls upon us when we are in the proximity of or in the building with a human corpse. But we still wash our hands. That's the minhag Yisrael, in order to signify that we're trying to raise up our hands. Yadayim askani odhein, the hands that have been involved with this. Now we're trying to get away from it and signify it through our action. Abnatilat yadayim. And that's why we wash our hands when we wake up in the morning. It's also related for this concept. Is that when we wake up in the morning, we're concerned with several factors. The Mishnah Berurah sums it up very beautifully. He says, first of all, the idea of washing one's hands, as the Rosh writes, is because a person's hands might have touched some element of their body that was unclean at night. So therefore, there's a bracha on this Netilat Yadayim, because one is going to recite Kriyat Shema, and one is going to stand and recite the Amidah. So one washes one's hands in order to clean them. The Rashba says, in the morning, we're a new creature. Kiberia Chadasha. As the pasuk in Sefer Eicha, Megillat Eicha, and Sefer Kinot tells us, Chadashim labkarim rabbayim unatecha. From there is Mode'ani, and from there the idea of renewal as of the morning. So we have to give thanks to Hashem that He created us for His glory, and that we are there to serve Him and to bless in His name. Therefore, we have the bracha that we recite in the morning. Very beautifully, the Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim, who saw Meir HaKohen Kagan, he's a Kohen, and he adds another idea. That the washing in the morning is actually kikohen shemekadesh yadav minaki or kodam avodato. We're going out to our day's work as kohanim, maybe not in a mikdash, but as a mamlechet kohanim into the world. And therefore, we wash our hands in the morning. It should be three times on each hand, alternating, right, left, right, left, right, left. And then we recite the bracha until yadayim. When can you recite the bracha? You don't have to recite the bracha when your hands are wet for that one. You could recite the bracha anytime after you've dried your hands, as long as you haven't touched something unclean afterward. So then you make the bracha later. Some people have the minhag to recite that bracha already in shul, if they go to shul. Other people recite it when they're no longer standing in a restroom or some such place. But what's the idea? Once again, Netilat Yadayim is an affirmation of all of these themes. And in Leil HaSeder, it's a reminder that this is part and parcel of our Masorah, and what differentiates us as Jewish people. By the by, at the Seder, you could ask, okay, I washed my hands already for Urchatz. I have to wash my hands again for the bread? I have to wash my hands again for the Maror? So the Gemara itself says, we're concerned that because of the fact that he spent so much time telling the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim and reciting Hallel, so maybe Asuche Asche Ledate V'Naga. Maybe it was a distraction. Maybe you touched something unclean, maybe something happened. Even at the Seder itself, I'm engaged in the actions concerning Kedusha and the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, and maybe I wasn't so focused. So before we're going to eat that wet vegetable again, meaning we're dipping, the Maror is also getting dipped into the Charoset, before we're going to eat bread, of course, if you hold that it's a separate reason that we're washing for bread, which as the Bali Tosfot and others maintain, okay, so you have to make the bracha Netilat Yadayim again, you have to wash your hands again, and that's called Rachza. Another insight from Jonathan Haidt's book, From the Righteous Mind. He talks about a professor at the University of Toronto named Shenbo Zhang, who has done research to show that subjects who are asked to wash their hands with soap before filling out questionnaires become more moralistic about issues related to moral purity. Once you're clean, he continues, you want to keep dirty things far away. Zhang has also shown the reverse process. Immorality makes people want to get clean. People who are asked to recall their own moral transgressions or made to copy by hand an account of someone else's moral transgression find themselves thinking about cleanliness more often and wanting more strongly to cleanse themselves. They are more likely to select hand wipes and other cleaning products when given a choice of consumer products to take home with them after the experiment. Zhang calls this the Macbeth effect, named for Lady Macbeth's obsession with water and cleansing after she goads her husband into murdering King Duncan. Further along, in other words, there's a two-way street between our bodies and our righteous minds. Immorality makes us feel physically dirty, and cleansing ourselves can sometimes make us more concerned about guarding our moral purity. In one of the most bizarre demonstrations of this effect, Eric Helzer and David Pizarro asked students at Cornell University to fill out surveys about their political attitudes while standing near or far from a hand sanitizer dispenser. Those told to stand near the sanitizer became temporarily more conservative. Moral judgment, concludes Haight in this section of the book, is not a purely cerebral affair in which we weigh concerns about harm, rights, and justice. It's a kind of rapid, automatic process more akin to the judgments animals make as they move through the world, feeling themselves drawn toward or away from various things. Let's consider what that means and the relationship between washing one's hands and morality, and the sense that one's engagement with Netilat Yadayim reminds an individual on a basic, visceral level about the notions of morality and cleanliness. NPR had a story in 2010 about a psychology researcher at the University of Michigan named Spike W.S. Lee, who wondered if hand-washing could restore more people, could restore more than just a sense of moral purity. I want to take it to the next level. So he said, there's an expression, cleanliness is next to godliness. But people often also talk about starting over with a clean slate. And so he wondered, maybe there's a broader phenomenon here that anything from the past, any kind of negative emotional experiences, might be washed away if one washing one's hands. Indeed, in 2015, the U.S. National Library of Medicine, National Institutes of Health, has a story about a study called Hand Washing Induces a Clean Slate Effect in Moral Judgments. And it goes on to describe, physical cleansing is commonly understood to protect us against physical contamination. However, recent studies showed an additional effects on moral judgments. If you keep reading this study, the researchers write, importantly, the psychological effect of physical cleansing is not limited to the moral domain. That's one aspect, but it's not limited to moral domain. Recent studies showed that hand washing one's hands can wash off traces of the past in general. First Kadesh, and then Urchatz. We're washing our hands of having been in Mitzrayim. We're washing our hands at being in a place that was so dirty and decadent and depraved. We're washing our hands of not being able to assert our freedom. We're washing our hands so that our children should ask us, is there still a concept of Tumah and Tahara in this world? And we answer them in the affirmative. Let every parent and grandparent take to heart, during the Seder and beyond the Seder, if you don't talk to your kids about issues of Tumah and Tahara and Judaism's views of same, the street will speak for you. Outside sources will instead decide what morality is and is not. Let every parent open up a Sefer Torah and open up a Gemara and open up the various Sefer Kodesh that deal with these issues. Let them seek guidance on it in order to guide the next generation. Urchatz and Rachatz are both critical elements not only of the Leil HaSeder, but for the year entire. I want to conclude with a story about the youngest son of the Sfas Emes. Everybody knows that the son of the Sfas Emes, the next Gerer Rebbe, who made it to Eretz Yisrael, the Imre Emes, he had a brother whose name was Reb Mendel Alter. And just to understand, he was the president of the Association of Rabbis of all of Poland. He was the rabbi of a town of Pabianz. He was deported to Treblinka. I read about him first as a child in a book written by a rabbi who was at Or Torah and part of Or Torah at its founding, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, in his book, With God in Hell. There's a chapter there entitled Confrontation, the Ultimate Issue. And in this book, Rabbi Berkowitz tells a story about what happened when the Gerer Rebbe's son, Rabbi Mendel Alter, actually the son of the Sfas Emes, arrived at Treblinka. They were walking toward the gas chambers, and along the way, a badly wounded child was thrown across Rabbi Mendel's path. He picked up the bleeding baby whose little body was quivering in his hands. There was still time, writes Rabbi Berkowitz. The Germans dragged out the death march for their entertainment. Rabbi Mendel, holding the child, turned to the others and said, quote, and this quote is actually appears in a sefer called Elish Lo Nichnu by Rabbi Moshe Prager, which is being quoted by Eliezer Berkowitz. Holding the child, here's what Rabbi Mendel said, this is holiness, purer than all purity, a Jewish child. This little Jewish child is sick, weak like a fly. How come the Satan, in possession of the most advanced weapons of war and destruction, has to wage war and vent his cruelty on little children, these quote-unquote defiled ones, when they see a Jewish child in the arms of his mother, are immediately filled with the urge to murder? The forces of Tuma, demonic defilement, cannot endure the sight of holiness, the spirit of purity that hovers over the face of a Jewish child. And according to those who were there, it was one who escaped from Treblinka who brought this story. Apparently he relayed the story that when the Nazis came to his home and beat and torture him, it hurt him very much and he was in great pain. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz writes the story in translation. He says, but suddenly his eyes were opened with understanding. The Germans discovered a scroll of the Torah in his room. At once they let him go and they threw themselves with cruel anger and mad murderous desire upon the Sefer Torah. They trod upon it with their feet and they tore the parchment with fanatical hatred as if sensing that the letters on them contained the lifeblood of the Jewish people. Rabbi Mendel concluded his remarks and he said, when I saw this, I regained my composure. I understood the meaning of the words in the Tillim. You make me wise through my enemies. It's not my body that the enemy means to crush. When he fights against the source of holiness, he slaughters the children of Israel. And when he wants to destroy the strength of the Jew, he treads underfoot the parchment of the Torah. But that's not the end of this story. Apparently the rabbi of Pabyansk, Rabbi Mendel Alter, a president of the Association of Rabbanim, of the Agudas HaRabbanim of Poland, when they got to the place where they had to undress, he realized what was going to be happening there in Treblinka. There was a kapo there. And he went to the kapo, and he said to him, I promise you, Olam Haba, if you bring me a little bit of water. The kapo, who was known for his cruelty, seemed to have been very taken by this request. And he ran and he brought water to the rabbi, thinking that in his last moments he's thirsty, he wants to drink something in order to slake his thirst before he goes to be killed. But of course, Rabbi Mendel Alter didn't need the water to drink. He took it for something else. He washed his hands in the Tilat Yadayim, and he called out to the Jews who were there, Jews, Yehudim, Hava v'nomar vidui lifnei ha'mavet. He said, let's daven the vidui together. The rabbi started the vidui, they all started davening together, and suddenly in came a Nazi, Yimach Shemo, and he said, what is this here, a Beit Tefillah? And the SS opened fire, and they were all killed at that time. The Ponovitcher Rav of Kahaneman, I found out after I gave this drasha, the Shabbos HaGadol drasha, of Kahaneman actually told the story that I told at the beginning of this drasha, and he linked it to this story of the Mendel Alter. He said, Lefanecha shashert mi Rabbi Akiva ad Rabbi Mendel, a chain that links Rabbi Akiva to Rabbi Mendel. And that the idea of a person who is connected to this is a person who's connected to Torah and Mitzvot and to Kedusha, to a life of Tahara and of connection to Eretz Yisrael and to Am Yisrael. Yehi ratzon that we should be worthy of that claim, that we should be Jews who are strict and punctilious in our observance of Mitzvot, that we perform with joy and a sense of life and animation about our role as Jews, of a Melechet Kohan, of a Goy Kadosh in this world, to better the world such as it is, through our kiyum of mitzvot, through our care for others, but of course, forever and always, asserting the degree to which the distinction between Tuma and Tahara still matters in this world, the extent to which we seek to infuse this world with Kedusha, with the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We can't start by making big campaigns in the whole world if we haven't yet spoken with our own families about these matters. May we be worthy of this charge between Parshiot Achrei Mot and Kedoshim, which speak about the notions of Tuma and Tahara, and in a book that is known as the Sefer HaKedusha, associated such as it is with the aspiration for holiness in our lives. Once again, this shir is dedicated to Le'ili Nishmat Mori V'Rabi, Harav Aaron Ben Yechiel, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha.